I really wanted to make a record that would be out there for a long time, and I feel really proud about, because we were going into the 90s and I wanted to have a great record for the 90s.
You know it's true, everything I do, oh, I do it for you.
Everything I Do was recorded for the film, obviously, and at the time when we recorded that song, I'm going to beat you to the question.
Okay.
But we didn't really know what to think about the song, and we thought it was a good track, but whether we thought it would be as big as it was really...
No one would have
predicted that. We broke from literally from playing from clubs all the way up to big concert arenas, from playing all the time, nonstop, always playing gigs. We took any gig, anytime, anywhere. And that's how we did it, you know, we just worked all the time.
Hey, this is Brian Adams in the studio for the Waking Up the Neighbors.
About the subject of success, Jethro Tull leader Ian Anderson once told me that, and I quote, "It's hard to have an arm long enough to pull the emergency brake on the gravy train." Keep that image in mind as the story unfolds about Brian Adams' 1991 sixth album, Waking Up the Neighbors. You see, Brian's fourth album, Reckless, in 1984, became one of that decade's most popular. So when the follow-up, Into the Fire, was released in 1987, it was doomed to comparison, which was probably unrealistic and certainly unfair. So for the next album, Adams wisely decided to bring in fresh ears, new blood for his creative production team, and worked for a full year hard at it. And the results? Brian Adams decided to scrap the entire thing. So after all of that time and considerable expense, what was Plan B for what would become Waking Up the Neighbors? So I asked the guy who would know, Brian Adams, here in the studio.
Well, we started out doing the same thing as we normally do, which is write 10 songs and go in the studio. And then it turned into 15 songs, and then we tried some different producers, different engineers, and ended up working with Mutt Lange on the album. It was about a year and a half of just trying things and experimenting before we actually came down with a formula for the record.
Was that frustrating at all?
No, it was actually quite exciting. There was a lot of things we tried, and tried a bunch of studios, spent way too much money in studio time. Yeah, I guess a few good dinners as well. But basically, it was pretty trial and error for the first little while, because I really wanted to make a record that would be out there for a long time, and I feel really proud about, because we were going into the 90s, and I wanted to have a great record for the 90s.
Yeah.
Bryan Adams scored a number two hit with Can't Stop This Thing We Started, a snappy little shuffle from the album Waking Up the Neighbors. I asked Bryan what it was about Robert John Mutt Lange that first attracted Adams to call on the producer.
Well, I think primarily one thing I noticed about all the records he's made with, you know, with the Cars or AC/DC or with Foreigner was the vocals sounded great. And once I started working with Mutt, I realized that Mutt, in fact, is a singer himself. So to be able to work with someone that can sing is quite a good thing for a singer, because it pushes you to do better. And that's exactly what happened. So I think that's one of the main reasons. You have to follow your instinct on music all the time. You always have to feel really good about your record before you release it. I've always felt that way at the end of a mix or at the end of recording 10 or 15 songs. But in the first year, I never felt that we'd actually put a record together. So the thing to do was to keep trying. And once I met Mutt, I think things became more focused, and he was able to help me arrange and write songs that were, you know, going to be what is this album. And a lot of the year and a half that I spent with other people writing and recording, we honed in on a few of those ideas, rewrote them, rearranged them, and they are, you know, songs like Another Tonight, Do I Have to Say the Words, House Arrest, and those songs are sort of a conglomeration of, the first year and what was to be the last year of recording.
Put on your best dress, darling. Can't you see the time is right? There will never be another tonight.
Check it out.
Bryan Adams scored another hit from Waking Up the Neighbors with There Will Never Be Another Tonight in November 1991. Next, Bryan confirms Henry Ford's adage that success is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Bryan Adams for the 25th anniversary of the 16 million seller Waking Up the Neighbors.
Hey, this is Bryan Adams in the studio for the anniversary of Waking Up the Neighbors.
And I'm Redbeard. Bryan Adams' decision to pack 50% more songs onto this album set an industry precedent that forced other bands to provide more music for the money. But Bryan confided to me in front of a live studio audience that his motivations weren't always altruistic, just practical.
Well, I think, first of all, it's been a long time since I made a record. And I thought it would be good to have a full CD of music. And plus, I think that, you know, times have changed now. I think people, because things are so expensive, it's nice to have a record with lots of music. And I don't know.
Amen.
There was some arguments of whether or not it was going to be a good idea because it's almost too much stuff to listen to. It's 75
We have enough. Well, dissenters out there
but,
in your live audience.
You know, there was a lot of debate about whether it was too much or not. And
no such thing.
We decided we recorded 15 songs that we liked. Let's put them all out. Because by the time we record another record, those songs would probably be from a different time and things would have changed. And so why wait? Let's put them all out now.
Crazy, it's gotta be strong.
Reaching number 8 in the UK, number 13 in America, Thought I'd Died and Gone to Heaven reminds us that Bryan Adams had a hit song with the Eternal Paradise in its title almost a decade earlier. Heaven had been a soundtrack-only film song from an obscure movie, but it had set up what would become Bryan's blockbuster Reckless. Bryan recalls those days and nights of busting his hump, playing to anyone who would listen.
In 82, we were opening for the Kinks. It was, you know, everybody in a van. And
No custom tour bus. Econoline van.
Well, no, actually, we did have a bus later on, but it was buses and motels and greasy food. Mickey didn't join us for a few years because he was doing other gigs, and Tommy didn't like the road, the keyboard player. But Dave and Keith, my bass player and guitarist, both have been with me since 82 and slogged it out through all the greasy spoons, man. So we've been together for a long time.
How important have these loyalties been to your career?
Absolutely, the most important thing. I mean, I believe a lot of it has to. A lot of the reason we do well is because we've stuck together, and things change. I mean, that's part of life. But one thing I'd like to be able to keep is my band. That's a great bunch of guys, and I love being on tour with them. It's excellent. I guess the big break probably was thanks to a band called Journey and my manager back in 83 when they gave us the Journey tour down there, and it really opened up America for us. And I got to thank a lot of people. I mean, the list goes on and on. Tina Turner for our tour in Europe, and I think a lot of it has to do with touring with acts. I mean, we broke from literally from playing from clubs all the way up to big concert arenas, from playing all the time, nonstop, always playing gigs. We took any gig, anytime, anywhere, and that's how we did it. You know, we just worked all the time. Once we got focused on what we were doing, it was we honed in on 10 songs, and we worked pretty much on those 10 songs for a while. And then we wrote two more, and we worked on 12 songs for a while. And then we had about 6 or 8 weeks of time where we were just waiting to work with Bob Clearmountain, who was going to mix the record. And we decided we would record some B-sides, which ended up being Hey Honey, I'm Packing You In. And
some B-side.
Everything I Do It For You. Everything I Do was recorded for the film, obviously. And at the time when we recorded that song, we didn't really know what to think about the song. And we thought it was a good track, but whether we thought it would be as big as it was really...
No one would have
predicted that.
Look into my eyes, you will see what you mean to me. Search your heart, search your soul, and when you find me there, you'll search no more. Don't tell me it's not worth trying for. You can't tell me it's not worth dying for. You know it's true. Everything I do it for you. Look into your eyes. Thank you. know it's true. Everything I do. Oh, I do it for you.
The song Everything I Do It For You, with lyrics by Brian Adams over a melody composed by the late maestro Michael Kamen, ran under the closing credits to the Kevin Costner film Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
You know, the fact that it's become an international success has a lot to do with the fact that I got involved in some film work.
Right.
And, I mean, if you imagine the music business to be the size of your thumbnail, then the film business is the size of your hand. You know, it's such an immense, it has branches to places you wouldn't even imagine. So everyone loves a movie. Yeah!
Song went on to 7 weeks at number one in America and a record-setting 16 weeks on top of the British chart.
And so what happened is, you know, by being involved in that, I was able to play around the world. I mean, in places I could never have imagined. I mean, from everywhere from South Korea to the Philippines to Vietnam, the whole Asian area, to India, to the Middle East, to South Africa, into South America, around the world. And so when you talked earlier about the whole idea of being a small world, well, when you have to do 24-hour flights, let me tell you, man, it's a big world.
Does the medium of film, does that get into places in the world that even rock music doesn't?
Yes, it does. And I love being involved in the film world because I think it's a great opportunity, again, to challenge myself musically. Every time I've done something in film, it's always been quite different, and it's brought out something else in my writing that I didn't know I could do. So I hope to do more of it. And yeah, I mean, we've been nominated 3 times for Academy Awards, so it's a good reason to stick with it.
Dancing on the table, dancing on the chair.
Tapping the Cuff on House Arrest from Brian Adams. Still to come, Brian explains how and when inspiration for a song appears, and how he had a passport long before he had a guitar. Follow In the Studio on Facebook. Visit InTheStudio.net for lots more. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Brian Adams. 16 million seller blockbuster, Waking Up the Neighbors.
Hey, this is Brian Adams in the studio for the Waking Up the Neighbors.
Thank you, buddy. I'm Redbeard, revisiting one of the 90s biggest albums, Waking Up the Neighbors. I was curious if Brian Adams had any particular method, creative device, place, or time to be inspired to write a song.
Oh, the oddest times. I mean, sometimes I'd be at a football match and you know, I'll think of something and I'll have to scramble around for a piece of paper. And, you know, if you're traveling in a car and you're thinking of something, you know, you've got to do the same thing. But generally, if I'm thinking of words, I just put them on whatever's in my pocket. And then later on, I put them in a book or on my computer or something.
Have you ever remembered that you had some kind of inspiration for a lyric or a song or something and misplaced any of those?
You know, I don't want to think about that, Redbeard. I'm sure there's been times where I've lost a scrap of paper. But I can recall on my album, on 18 Till I Die, that I'd written a song title down from just something I said to somebody one night. And I said, you know, the only thing that looks good on me is you. So it's like a bad chat-up line. And I wrote it down. I thought that was quite funny. And then, you know, 2 years later, it became a song. I tend to keep track of things that I say, because sometimes I just blurt out something. Oh, that could be a song title. I better write that down.
You know, your dry cleaner had a hit a few years back. Imagine that.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, exactly.
Long before his musical talent would take him to countries most North Americans sadly can't even find on a map, Bryan Adams had an up-close and personal worldview.
You know, wherever I lay my hat, it's my home. When I was with my folks growing up, we traveled around the world quite a bit. My father was a diplomat, and so we traveled pretty extensively around Europe and the Middle East. So I'm a global nomad, Beard. That's my gig, man.
Well, you knew it was a small world before the rest of us did. You knew that it was world music.
It's not a small world, man. It's a big-ass world, okay? It's big. It's a lot. It's a, it, you know, it's, and it's hard to cover it, you know? Sometimes I wish there was two of me so we could... We could do two things at once, but it's kind of hard to do that.
Well, there's some doctor that's working on it right now.
I'm up for it.
Tell me about your relationship with Keith and why it's lasted. Obviously, there's got to be even more than a musical bond here.
Well, we met in Toronto in 1976, and we were sort of in rival bands at the time, and we went and had a cup of tea, and we had a talk about music. And a couple of years later, when I was putting my album together and my first sort of touring band, I called him, and he came out with me. And the only way I can really describe what it's like to have sort of a friend, a brother, if you like, to have working with you for such a long time is the other night we were talking about going on tour again, and I was like, oh, going on tour. I was just dreading the idea of going out again. And I looked at the sort of, you know, 2 or 3 month schedule on it. And then Keith walked in the room, and I thought to myself, you know, that's the reason why I go. I said, Keith, you know, man, when I see you, now I want to go out. I said, until you walked in the room, I was ready to go home. So, you know, there's a reason why we still play together as a band. The whole band I have has been together for a long time. And, you know, we don't have a name for the band like the Heartbreakers or the E Street Band or something like that. Maybe we should be called the Dudes of Leisure. But we've been together a long time. And that, you know, Keith isn't the only guy. Dave Taylor plays bass with me. He's been a long time. Mickey Curry plays drums with me a long time. Tommy Mandel and plays keyboards. You know, we've all been together. And I've been quite loyal to a lot of people in my business, whether it's Bob Clearmountain who does their mixing or the songwriters I've worked with. You know, I like the idea of staying.
Personal manager.
My personal manager, who we've been together since I was 18. So, you know, it's about a brotherhood. It's not about sort of flitting and flattening around all over the place. You know, I'm comfortable with the people I met, and I stick with them.
I've known Bryan Adams for 35 years now, and I can honestly say that his enthusiasm for life, music, and people that was so likable about him when we first met, it hasn't diminished at all.
We played a gig in Egypt. We played in front of the pyramids, and we did a concert in front of the Sphinx. And I had to pinch myself. I turn around and look at Mickey Curry, my drummer, and right behind him was the Sphinx. It's just like you couldn't ask for a better setting. So I mean, those kind of things, and you know, I'll never forget them. There, we've been really lucky that the music that we've made over the last umpteen decades has transcended beyond, you know, way beyond any borders I would have ever expected, certainly from beyond my basement. And we can play practically anywhere. There's not a country in the world I can't go to and do a concert. I suppose the most difficult times were the beginnings, but they were also kind of great times too, because when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. Like I was saying to you earlier, Redbeard, you know, you already know the answer is no, so you just got to go for the yes. You know, struggling to get people to recognize and support and believe, and it was work. And you know, you go to extreme lengths to, and way beyond what things you'd ever expect to do to get the message across. And it's been a fascinating trip. I mean, and it's not over. I'm so incredibly grateful for the, you know, times I've had. And you know, I often say to friends, you know, hey, well, if it all ended tomorrow, it's been great. You know, but it doesn't seem to be ending, and there's more music being made.
I don't really think about the whole album sale thing. I don't really pay attention to it, and I'm only into this for making music, and it's a great opportunity for me to reinvent and to keep changing, and I don't want to sit still. I'm as excited about making music today as I was when I first started, and I'm into it for music. I'm not into it for the glamour or the celebrity or the, you know, I love writing songs, and I love going on tour with my band, and that's what I do.
Bryan Adams' new concert DVD called Wembley, Live 1996 from London. This famed performance at the Big Bowl captures Bryan Adams blazing through a career-spanning set. Wembley Live 1996 is available now digitally and on DVD. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest and my friend, Bryan Adams. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2016, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In The Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.